on 2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now. Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Good evening and welcome to Game On. It's Tuesday the 10th of May and you're listening to myself and Shane. Thanks to the two Johnnies on this evening's show, we will have news on Erling Haaland's transfer to Manchester City.
Great move, great goal, two for Haaland. Slots his hat-trick, it's too easy. Haaland's it again!
We'll also preview Liverpool's trip to Steven Gerrard's Aston Villa, and in rugby, Toulon coach James Collin will tell us how Leinster can beat Toulouse this weekend, and in swimming, we'll find out about the pop-up pool making its way around the country. As always, if you want to get in touch, you can do so by texting us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
So, Shane, it was a good night of League of Ireland last night. Shamrock Rovers are back top, but what's today's news?
Yes, indeed, Ruby. The title race continues in League of Ireland and a big weekend ahead. But today's news, as you alluded to there, Manchester City have confirmed that they have signed Borussia Dortmund's Erling Haaland, and that transfer will go through on the 1st of July 2022. We'll have more on that in a few moments in our football chat in the company of Paul Corey and Mark Langdon. In other news, bad news, Ruby, actually, for lovers of video games, because FIFA and EA Sports look set to end a near three-decade video game partnership. The current deal, which was to end after this year's World Cup in Qatar, has been adjusted to run through to the Women's World Cup next summer. Once that tournament is over, the company said 150 million FIFA video game players will have to get used to a new name for the series, EA Sports FC. The game itself will not change much. Most of the world's famous clubs and stars will still be playable because of separate licensing deals with their teams and leagues, even though the World Cup itself and other FIFA-controlled events will no longer be included. Sticking with soccer, Athlone Town captain Laurie Ryan is the Women's National League Player of the Month for April. In rugby, the EPCR have decided against retaining the two-legged round of 16 in next season's Heineken Champions Cup. Tournament organisers have confirmed the provisional dates for the 2022-23 competition, which will be played over 8 rounds rather than 9 of this season. We'll be chatting to James Collin on that and everything else in the rugby world in a few moments. Connacht have confirmed the release of 7 additional players at the end of the season, including experienced back row Owen Masterson. And finally, Ruby, the perfect bit of news on a day when we have yourself, the Game On racing expert, amongst other things, I have to say, and we'll be previewing Aston Villa versus Liverpool a little bit later on. The Royal Ascot Trials Day at Nace continues to attract some of the brightest prospects with some high profile entries for this Sunday's fixture. So the Group 3 Coolmore Stud EBF Fillies Sprint Stakes has attracted 12 entries, including 6 maiden winners, to be fair. But it could well be the Michael O'Callaghan's debutante who attracts the most interest, being a €450,000 filly bought at the Breeze Ups, who runs in the colours of Ammo Racing and is partly owned by Philippe Coutinho. So Coutinho owns half of her and they're trying to get the registration sorted in time so his name appears on the race card. As always, you can get more info on these stories and more on the RT News app and website. But Ruby, have you seen Philippe Coutinho knocking about a few race courses in the past?
I haven't. Ammo Racing are absolutely flying, but I haven't seen Philippe Coutinho. Did he have man, all right? Might see him around a bit, but not Philippe Coutinho. I'm just trying to think, will he be in Nace on Sunday? Highly unlikely. Yeah. I'd imagine maybe if that filly that he owns half of were to win on Sunday and turn up at Royal Ascot, you might see Philippe Coutinho, but I shall be surprised if he makes his way down the M7 from Dublin Airport to Nace on Sunday afternoon.
You never know. There is a bit of a crossover. You mentioned Didi Hammond, Michael Owen, I think, enjoys
Michael Owen, definitely, yeah.
He's Sir Alex Ferguson, obviously, as well.
Yeah. John Kevin Doyle, big breeder.
Kevin Doyle, yeah. John Small, Dublin GAs. John Small, I think, owned a bit in a horse race not too long ago, but I'm sure there are many, many others.
I'd say Charlie Carter is probably the most famous. I saw him leading up a winner at Leopardstown over Christmas.
Okay.
Horse that he owned himself, led it up in the parade ring, sold it. It's gone to America, actually. So okay. It is.
So that's proper. That's all in. That's not just getting your name in a race card.
That's all in.
That's
hands on. Hands on that issue.
Well, Manchester City are all in on Erling Haaland Ruby as we turn our attention to football in the company of Paul Corey and Mark Langdon. Paul, if I come to yourself first, I suppose, listen, it was greatly speculated this week and we thought it was going to happen. The ever reliable Fabrizio Romano broke the news yesterday, but the club themselves tweeted about it today. So it's finally over the line, done deal. How beneficial will this be to Manchester City Football Club?
Yeah, it's mega news. I mean, he's a massive player and he's got obviously an incredible record of scoring goals at Borussia Dortmund, at Salzburg, even with the national team in Norway. And he's obviously a striker who's got a number of promising years ahead of him. I think with the father's allegiance to Man City and the package that Man City are able to put around the player, I think it was probably always likely to be the destination for Haaland. The fact that Benzema is banging form from Madrid as well probably lessens the need for a number 9 there. But massive player. Listen, it probably gives them another dimension, Shane, in regards to how they can play. You know, they haven't always had that physical presence of a number 9. You've seen Grealish play through the middle. We've seen Foden. Gabriel Jesus isn't exactly a natural number 9. And Aguero in his last number of years while he's at Man City probably wasn't the same sort of Aguero. So this gives them that focal point. He's just he really is a bear of a man. You know, he's got a physique to him that maybe Man City lack at certain times. And even when they're defending set pieces, sometimes you look at them and think physically they're quite a small side. But he's guaranteed goals. I'm probably not one of these people who sits there and says that Man City desperately need a number 9. I don't agree with that. But what I do agree with is that maybe he has the potential to get them over the line in some of the more important games. You think back to the Real Madrid game where potentially they could have converted one or two more of their chances and they would have gone through. Is that the reason they didn't go through? Probably not. They scored, 4 goals over the course of the two legs. It certainly wasn't an offensive problem they have. But this is just another string to the bow. He is an incredible centre forward and he's only going to get better playing under Guardiola. Playing with Man City, you're going to get a hell of a lot of chances in that 6-yard box. That's where he tends to spend most of his time. Holds up the ball well, big, powerful, strong, great left foot, and scary for other teams who are trying to keep up and chase Man City.
Mark Langdon of the Racing Post, who is a regular on our Tuesday evenings, joins us as well. Mark, Erling Haaland, $51.2 million. How is he not working?
Yeah, well? I mean that's a cheap transfer fee in sort of the current market. There's no doubt about that. But there's a lot more to that than just the 50 odd million. There's a lot of fees that have to be paid, and then the wages. Where although they're saying that it is not breaking the kind of structure that City have got in place, it is expected to be somewhere in the region of 400,000 a week, which is kind of the level that Kevin De Bruyne is on. So it is an expensive deal, albeit that the transfer fee is sort of far more palatable. Just to quickly get back there to the horse racing owners, Antoine Griezmann in France owns horses, probably one of the real sort of big names. But in terms of Haaland, I tend to agree that some people seem to think that he's, like the missing piece in the jigsaw. I'm not sure that that's the case. I mean, he improved City in terms of their goal-scoring ability, of course. But, football's not a game where if you just add a striker, that automatically means he'll convert all the chances. Because one of the reasons that City create so many chances is their domination of the ball. And the reason that they dominate the ball is because they often play with 6 midfielders. So that'll be one less midfielder in there. And the game can end up being completely different. I think the one area where he really does help City is that I think a lot of teams now sort of say to Manchester City, you can have the wide areas and put crosses in and we'll look to deal with that threat. Of course, Haaland in there, he's very good in the air. So that does add another dimension. But, I mean, sort of Yeah, it wasn't that long ago we were saying that Lukaku was the missing piece in what Chelsea were trying to do. And if anything, the team got worse when he was in it. So it's never, you know, I never go for it. It's bomb-proof and, you know, this will definitely work. He's a great player. It should work. But there are no guarantees in football that it will.
Paul, do you think Haaland coming to City will help Jack Grealish? Now, he cost $100 million last year. I don't know. Has he set the world on fire at the Etihad this year? Does he need a centre-forward in there when he's standing at the edge of the box to be aiming at?
Yeah, potentially. And that's touching on Mark's point as well, in the sense that it gives maybe another direction to goal, and the fact that he can start supplying a big man up front. I don't know is the honest answer to that, Ruby. I think when you see players and the transition that they have when they come across from other clubs to play for Pep Guardiola, some of them do need 6 to 12 months. So, you know, you think of João Cancelo, who's probably somebody who didn't start a huge number of games. Yes, he was coming from Europe, but it took him a long time to get into the swing of things with the Guardiola style of play, and maybe that positional sense and the patience that you need to have in build up. There's certainly more to come from Jack Grealish. I think probably playing in that system for this year will probably benefit him moving into next year. But Haaland, yes, potentially it might free up a bit of room. Maybe there's the case that you can go into Haaland maybe a bit more direct and play off and get Grealish and co up the pitch higher and earlier before teams kind of settle into that low block that you tend to see. But it's going to be a different way of playing. Like Mark touched on it there, there's not going to be maybe the same sort of freedom from a Haaland, because he's not got the same sort of agility of a Foden if he's playing through the middle, and that might be maybe take a bit of getting used to for the likes of Grealish and co. But it'll be interesting to see how they use him. You know, Mark has probably touched on it there, the big man syndrome that you've seen with Lukaku with Chelsea. Haaland for me is probably a bit more of a footballer. He's got a good touch. He's probably more natural with the ball at his feet than Lukaku, who sometimes seems to be chasing it when he takes his first touch, as a Chelsea fan can be terribly frustrating. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they set up. For me, Haaland plays every game, and whether it be Grealish or Foden or Mahrez or Sterling, it'll be interesting to see how kind of those players fit in around him.
I think Grealish personally is going to be excellent next year. I think he's taken a while to adapt to maybe Pep's style, and Foden's only going to improve as well. But Mark, given this transfer, and perhaps we might see Frankie de Jong or whoever else go to Manchester City, Liverpool are such a good team and they're sure to improve. We see Tony Rudiger, I think it's confirmed that he's going to Real Madrid now. Chelsea are set to lose a few players. Tuchel today, doing a bit of press, has mentioned that he's sitting on his hands basically while the behind the scenes and ownership kind of gets over line for Chelsea in terms of who they might get. Manchester United, it's a complete rebuild, and then who knows how other teams will strengthen. So does this, in terms of competitiveness for the Premier League, just create a two-horse race for the foreseeable future, and I suppose diminishes the quality in the amount of teams that can challenge realistically for a Premier League title?
I think that was the case even before today, really. I think that it would have been asking a lot, given Chelsea's issues at the moment, given where Manchester United are. Tottenham and Arsenal not good enough, I don't think, to make that step. So it will make it more difficult for anybody else. But I don't think that was sort of, you know, necessarily would have added that many points to Man City's total this season. They're already winning most games that they play. And, you know, I suppose the one area you would say is that Haaland's got and had, for somebody of his young age, quite a few injuries. So, there's bound to be times when he's just not playing through, through knocks or whatever. I tend to think that the Premier League's not that competitive right at the very top at the moment anyway, and I don't think that this makes a bigger difference. I think City are ultimately sort of looking and thinking the Champions League, and in signing Haaland, it means that, you know, one of their main rivals, you know, whether that be Real Madrid or Paris Saint-Germain, they're not getting him. So, the reasons for buying him, and you often see this with top clubs: one, you're getting a great player, and two, it means you're stopping one of your main rivals from getting them. I'm sure from sort of a Liverpool fan's point of view, they're probably looking at that thinking, you know, it's going to be even more difficult to challenge Manchester City next season. But Liverpool do it in a different way, and it's very successful for them too. So I'm not sure that, you know, signing Haaland makes Manchester City miles better than they already are. They're already a fabulous team, and it was going to be difficult for anybody to stop them next season, even before today's news.
Well, we will be previewing Aston Villa, Liverpool in due course, but one trophy that Manchester City won't be winning this year is indeed the Champions League. Now, we had Niamh Mahoney from Football Supporters Europe on the show a while back, and she was talking about the European Superclubs meeting in the background, and that unfortunately hasn't gone away yet. But UEFA met today, and it looks like European football's governing body is set to scrap its coefficient plan, and from 2024 will award two Champions League places to countries whose clubs collectively performed best in Europe the previous campaign. So the proposal to award two places in the new 36-team league phase based on individual clubs' European performances over 5 years has been scrapped, with critics arguing it created a safety net for failing big clubs and a Super League by default. So instead, two places will be awarded to clubs from the countries who performed best in Europe in the previous term. If it applied to next season, that would mean England gaining a spot along with the Netherlands. It's also understood the number of matches in the new look league phase per team will drop to 8, with the initial proposing being 10 matches. I'll withhold my personal views on the matter for now, but Mark, what do you make of this report coming out of UEFA for the new Champions League format?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, it's better than what they wanted, but I still don't agree with it. I mean, 10 games for a group stage would have been absolutely ridiculous. I still think 8 is too many. Yeah, they're kind of packaging it as, you know, it's 2 games fewer. I mean, it's not. It's 2 games more than we've got now. It's just 2 games fewer than the sort of ludicrous sort of opening suggestion. And I don't like the idea of, you know, handing out more Champions League spots to, you know, sort of leagues that don't really need it. You know, we've already, as you mentioned there, it would be the Premier League and the Netherlands this time around. You know, I think five teams from one country, you are kind of really pushing that towards sort of Super League territory. Of course, you might even get a Europa League winner chucked in there as well. And I actually think it could be bad for the Premier League. That race for fourth nearly every year is a really exciting one. And I think adding another spot there, you know, wouldn't do much for the Premier League. I just think that they're tinkering around too much with the Champions League. I understand the group stage isn't perfect, but you know, I just don't like giving more money to the teams that definitely don't need it. I mean, you are ultimately just going to make them even stronger and the rest of Europe sort of weaker. And that, you know, that divide will just continue to only go one way and grow in favour of the sort of big and richer clubs.
Mark, how does this even work? I mean, at 32 teams, 16 go through to the last 16. It's the top two in each group. When you make that 36, how do you play it out now?
So they're going to all play in one group, Ruben. So it's going to be one big, massive league table where you're going to play 8 matches, 4 home and 4 away against sort of teams of a certain calibre within seeding. So you still have seedings, and then you'll play one from kind of each tier of that. And then you'll get a certain amount of teams that just go directly through. I think it's 12 teams directly through, or maybe it's 8 actually, 8 teams that go directly through. So if you finish in the top 8, you go through. And then if you finish in the next 16 spots, so that would be what, 9 to 24, you would play off in sort of a knockout 2-legged tie to create the other 8 teams that would go through to the last 16. So rather than have Group A through to, you know, Group F or whatever it was previously, you're going to all play in one big league, albeit that you won't play against everybody.
It's just getting the European qualifiers, isn't it?
I agree with. Yeah, I mean, you're just going to end up with what feels like even more dead rubbers than you've got now. But it guarantees more games for the big teams. And, you know, UEFA feel like the group stage has become very stale and you're getting the same teams qualifying and almost like the same teams playing each other, which I do accept that there is a little bit of that. And, you know, you maybe get teams and you kind of know that they're going to finish bottom of a group. But I'm not sure the solution is to, you know, ultimately just give the bigger teams more money and make it probably even easier for them to qualify. I'd quite like to see a bit more of a random draw to the group stage. Maybe get rid of seeding. And yeah, that might throw up a couple of, you know, really big teams in the group stage. But so what?
I think we have to be careful how this is marketed, because UEFA now are kind of pushing the narrative that, oh, well, listen, it's 8 matches instead of 10, so, like, we're the good guys here. But I'm sorry, UEFA are meant to be in control of the competition, and they're the one making these changes. They're the one creating such a convoluted manner that, Mark, you've done very well in explaining it there, but a competition that should be accessible to everyone shouldn't need that in-depth explanation. It shouldn't need to get your calculators out or to have such a ridiculous formula as to how it can go about. And Paul, we see it with the expansion of tournaments. I mean, personally speaking, the greatest thing about the Euros internationally, I felt, was as a competition, it was the best teams in it. You had the most part, no one-sided affairs. You got the top talent battling it out, and now increasing teams in there can somewhat diminish the quality. But there's also been reports that there's support from clubs for ditching the two-leg semi-finals and instead have the last four teams competing in a week of football event in a single city, wherever that city may be. And you look at the drama from this year's semi-finals alone. I mean, taking that drama and taking football for what it's meant to be, a pure sport. I mean, this is just a slap in the face for the small sliver of hope that we have for keeping football somewhat pure. We change it into this festival. It's another nail in the, you know, in the coffin of real football departing, going away, and it turns into this ole ole festival, which it diminishes how important the football match is, and it turns it into a festival, which it shouldn't do.
Yeah, no, it shouldn't. And listen, I think you mentioned it there, Shane, about diminishing the product. And, you know, all you have to do is look at the Champions League to date, this year in particular, and look at Real Madrid's route to the final and the games that it's thrown up with Paris Saint-Germain, with Chelsea, and then with Man City. And you think, why would you try fixing it if it's not broken? And the only thing that you can point to is just money and greed. And it tends to be the only reason that these things are changed. The product, as you can see on the pitch, is superb. The level of football that we're seeing, particularly in the knockout stage of the Champions League, is unquestionable, and you can't deny that the level is going up and up year on year, and I don't see any reason to change that. But listen, all you have to do is look at the Champions League final and how difficult it is to get your hands on tickets.
Yeah.
The corporate tickets, sponsors. The corporate sponsors, the prices, it's just money, it's greed. And if they can find another way of flushing more cash into European competitions by changing the format, well, they'll try to do that.
20,000 seater stadium for the Conference League in Albania, and I have a few friends in Rome. 8,000 of those tickets are going to corporate sponsors and hospitality. So you're left with 12,000 among two clubs, two greatly supported clubs, Roma and Feyenoord, with 6,000 tickets each for a European Cup final. I know it's the Conference League, but still. Like, Mark, there was a UEFA press release even today. I think Camilla Cabello, whoever that is going to be performing at the Champions League pre-show. I mean, that again is adding unnecessary bells and whistles to something that should be a beautiful event in itself.
It should be. I mean, was it the one in when Liverpool had a Champions League final with Dua Lipa, I think, one year when they played Real Madrid, and the fans really liked that. But no, I think what they're trying to do with the Champions League, I mean, it's been spoken about, you know, at sort of very high level, about turning it into a Super Bowl, which is an event that sort of transcends the sport. But, you know, I football doesn't really, you know, the marketing behind football is the players and the game. It's not the halftime entertainment or the pre-game entertainment. You know, that's not what the sport is ultimately about. And, you know, it wouldn't be a massive surprise, would it, if you had like an extended halftime. You could see that coming for you know, Champions League in the future, with the way that they're kind of talking and just trying to make it all about the money. That Final Four sort of idea that was spoken about, I mean, just hasn't been thought through. The idea that, you know, you see how many fans sort of, you know, Rangers and Eintracht Frankfurt are taking to Seville next week for the Europa League final. Imagine if you had them two teams in it with Liverpool and Bayern Munich, for instance, and, you know, you've got four lots of fans, you know, taking, you know, what, 100,000 each or something crazy to one city. I mean, it just wouldn't, it wouldn't and couldn't possibly work. It's very different in international football, where, you know, fans tend to be based somewhere and then you travel around to games. So, I mean, I think that that would be an absolute flop, just from a fan's point of view. But UEFA, you know, are trying to just, I mean, it's pretty obvious, they're just trying to make as much money as they possibly can. And the way that they do that is, you know, to make those semi-finals sort of, you know, take it away from the clubs, if you like, so that, that they would have control of the pot and would probably charge ridiculous fees for the tickets like they have done for the Champions League final. And, you know, that they would also be looking at TV money in adding on these group stage games. They're just adding more fixtures, which means more money, even if it means less quality.
Mark, every game right now is a cup final for Liverpool. Tonight they're going down the road to Birmingham to take on Villa at Villa Park. Can Steven Gerrard end Liverpool's Premier League dream?
No, I'm not sure. I mean, I know Villa have picked up recently, and Liverpool, you know, weren't great against Tottenham, you know, and maybe have blown the any chance they had of winning the title. But I would still expect Liverpool to respond in the right manner against a Villa team that tended to struggle really against the best teams. And I'm not sure they're good enough defensively, like sort of Spurs were, you know, on Saturday, to stop that front three of Liverpool sort of, you know, scoring at least a couple of goals tonight. I would expect Liverpool to win and, you know, to finish their season well. And then they're just hoping for City to lose somewhere. Maybe at West Ham on Sunday is the most likely outcome. But I think Liverpool will do their part, certainly tonight.
Paul, I know you'll be sticking around for the hour, and we hope to have a bit of a team news later, and we'll be bringing you that in due course. But what's your read on this evening's big one? Because we've seen Liverpool blink at the weekend, so they'll be looking to bounce back from that for sure.
Yeah, I can't wait to see the team news and see how many under-18s players that Steven Gerrard puts in this Aston Villa lineup. No, I can't see Aston Villa taking anything from Liverpool here tonight. I thought on the weekend, I called on Saturday Sport, I thought they dropped points against Tottenham. I thought the turnaround was going to be too much, particularly with Tottenham having a full week to prepare. I don't think you're going to see the case here. I think there's difference in pure levels of quality within both squads, and Aston Villa aren't good enough at the back to hold Liverpool like Tottenham did for so long on the weekend. So too much firepower going forward. They've been ruthless on most occasions since the turn of Christmas, and their record, I think they've won all 18 games against teams in the bottom half this year. So anything but a Liverpool win would be a pure shock.
Mark, just before we let you go, most of the leagues around Europe are over and done with, but bar Serie A, AC Milan, Inter Milan, there's only 2 points between them, two games left to go. Will AC hold out?
I think they will. They've overcome some really tricky moments. They're able to draw one game. They've got the head-to-head advantage, so that they can even afford to draw one of their games. They had a really tricky game at Verona at the weekend. They fell behind. You felt like maybe that was the moment, you know, for this unlikely title bid to sort of fall short, and they battled back and they won the game against a team that caused them a lot of problems historically in terms of when they've been going for the title. The fans believe, I think there were more Milan fans inside that stadium than there were Verona ones, and yeah, I mean, it looks like they've done the hard work now. I would expect them to win it, and yes, they're a big name, but this is a big surprise. They were not expected to challenge and win the Scudetto this season, so it really will be a massive achievement if they manage to get over the line.
It surely would. Mark Langdon, thanks a million. We have a quick break to take, but when we come back, it'll be James Collin live from Toulon. If Shane can hit the break button.
Ruby, I tell you what, I am hitting the break button.
It's not working.
People just want to hear you too much. That's the problem here.
I swear to God, you don't understand the commercials.
No,
on,
I can tell you,
radio.
Listen, Ruby,
we really need the ads.
I know,
we have to pay the bills somehow.
We have to pay the sum hill. James Collins coming up in a few moments' time, so stick with us here at Game On.
RTE 2FM. On 2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now.
Game On.
Rugby.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On with myself, Shane Dawson, and Ruby Walsh as we turn attention to rugby. We nearly didn't want to leave you there, but unfortunately they had to do that for 90 seconds. But James Collin now joins us live from Toulon. James, always great to chat. I want to start off by reading you a quote that I saw in a recent interview that you'd done. So there's no job security, coaches rent houses, they don't buy them. I believe that was advice you got from a former Munster backroom team member. So 8 years in France now, five of those as a coach. How have you found it? Is it becoming a bit more enjoyable the more you settle in?
Hey, you know, it's always a challenge. It's enjoyable. I mean, it's otherwise, as I said in the quote, if I wanted security, I'd work in a bank. So, no, it's been brilliant. Loads of ups and downs along the way. So it's been amazing, and I'm loving every minute of it, to be honest with you, Shane.
Well, there has been certainly loads of ups and downs. There's been plenty of excitement both on and off the pitch for yourself at Toulon this year. You were even the man in charge for a short period. But listen, you're now planning for a Challenge Cup semi-final against Saracens. But before we talk about that specifically, just how much of a roller coaster has this season felt for you?
Yeah, it's been mad. Obviously, we knew that, like, as a staff, we knew... the talent we had in the group was always amazing. It was just finding a way that the lads would play as a team and find a way of winning. We thought we'd clicked, and then we got a bump in the road, and then you think you got it right again, but it's just we were beaten by Montpellier up in Montpellier. I think it was the start of March, and I think we came away knowing that, okay, they're the best team in the league, and we were within a kick of winning the game, and we've just gone on from there, basically, and we haven't lost a game since. So we're giving ourselves a chance. I think the lads have gotten a lot of confidence out of the games we've won. Like, we've beaten Toulouse, we've beaten Bordeaux away, we've beaten Lyon away, and I think things are kind of rolling on nicely now for us. So, as you say, going into a semi-final this weekend, facing a quality team in Saracens, packed with internationals and Lions and what have you. So it's another big weekend. We just keep saying 1 week more, you know, we're giving ourselves a chance to play for something every week. So hopefully we'll do the work and we'll see what happens on Saturday evening, you know.
Obviously, it was James Ruby here. It was London Irish he did beat in the last game. As you said, Saracens coming up. You've Poe at home, where you were yourself at the academy, and then Racing could be your last game in the Pro 14, or hopefully you'll be in a final against either, who's in the other side, Lyon or Wasps. Yeah. Like, the Pro 14 is such a competitive environment. You said, as Munster, the biggest games are always against the French teams. Is it more different now as a coach in France, preparing for those big games every week, whereas at Munster the big games were less often, I suppose?
Yeah. I know. It's different in the sense that it's so close now. I think the French leagues have done a good job in regards to salary caps and keeping everybody as close as they could. Obviously, we've spoken already, Drew Ruby, about the rules of French qualified players, the rules in regards to that. And it's kind of even out the league, you know. We're eighth and we're 2 points away from being fourth, you know. So it's four points away from being fourth. So, you know, it's just the top eight, top nine, even Clermont are a position behind us, can qualify. And that would, going into the last two rounds of the league, it's not very often in, regardless of what league, whether it's the Premier League, as you were talking about, or in the United Rugby League, that you would have such a grouping of teams so late in the season. Like in Montpellier and Bordeaux are first and second, but they're still not even sure to be qualified. So from all of us here, we're just thinking, like, okay, if we give Poe another chance of staying in the hunt, and then we go to Racing last game of the season, and if we win there, then we could qualify. So that's where we're at. But as you say, the Saris game this Saturday, and that one, then it gives ourselves a chance to playing a final only up the road, because Marseille is only an hour away. So it'll be we played Toulouse and Marseille, and there were 65,000 people at the game. So it's just we'll be hoping for the same kind of support if we manage to get there, you know.
Were you surprised Munster pushed Toulouse so close last Saturday?
No, I wasn't. I spoke to Jerry Tarnley during the week. The problem for Toulouse is the amount of quality players they have. You know, it's weird to say that, Ruby, but you know, they've it's basically France against Ireland this weekend, for example. You know, we played Toulouse a couple of weeks ago. We were lucky to get out the right side of the result, but they had to do squad rotation because guys have been playing all year, you know, they have so much quality, but like, it's tiring, you know. Just you're going from playing the All Blacks in November into winter season with the top 14, and then you're moving into they won the Grand Slam, they're moving into the French team, and then they're straight into trying to qualify for European competition as well as trying to qualify in the top 14. So it's I thought Munster were brilliant. I thought they did as much as they could do. It's just it's a horrible way for them to go out, you know. They worked their socks off, every one of them, and the bench were brilliant when they came on as well. It was just one of those days. Unfortunately, the lads, obviously after 100 minutes of rugby, it's kind of hard to get them to kick penalties at the end of the game, and I think the three kickers that Toulouse have are three of the best in the world. So they were just unfortunate. I think Toulouse, I think Leinster could do a job this weekend, considering the amount of effort that Toulouse have had to put into the last couple of weeks. I think Leinster could utilise that to their favour this weekend, you know.
You mentioned there, James, you were part of a coaching team that masterminded a victory over Toulouse not so long ago in the top 14. So for any Leinster fans listening in, or indeed even perhaps Leinster coaches listening in, what's the secret to getting the better of the mighty Toulouse?
Well, there isn't a secret. That's just it. It's, you know, we were very good in our line-out. We took away our line-out defence was excellent. We took away a big part of their game plan with their plays off the line-out. Our scrum was good, and defensively we were good. There's no secret, you know what I mean? It's just, the thing for them is they do the right thing at the right time. You can see it. They were 10 points down in 65 minutes against Munster this weekend, and they seem to just call the right thing at the right time. They managed to get front football, they managed to get quick ball. I think the secret, obviously, is the 9 and 10 channel. Obviously, they're two of the best players, Dupont and Intermarket, two of the best players in the world. And they can be the factor X. I mean, like, Dupont finished the match, and we were chatting here as a staff. I you know, you couldn't see what position he was playing, whether he was playing 9, whether he was playing 10, whether he was playing centre. He was on the wing sometimes, he was at 15 other times. It's just, and then he's the one kicking the goals to put them through. It's just, the guy is phenomenal. So I think Leinster will, I can't see Leinster keeping those two lads quiet for 80 minutes. They will have their proper patch, Toulouse always do. But I know they will put a big focus, the Leinster staff will be putting a big focus on that 9-10 channel and trying to cut off the source with big defence. I know James Ryan was excellent again at the weekend. I saw you three or four big steals on the line-out and the Leicester line-out. So they'll be looking to do much the same this weekend and have a really good kick game, because if you kick the ball cheaply to Toulouse, they'll punish you because they've quality everywhere. So it's a big ask for anybody, and it's just... you just got to be really disciplined and put yourself in the right positions and hopefully get the right side. I mean, the try that Gavin scored for us here was amazing. I'm sure you've probably seen the highlight somewhere. It's just a thing of magic, and that's what got us over the line at the end of it, you know.
You're obviously the defence coach in Toulon, so do you prepare differently when you're playing against Toulouse with Dupont and Intermac than you will to take on Saracens next weekend?
Not really. I think like the bit we focus on is they play a lot of it. They try and keep the ball alive. You see the big men Marchand and Arnold especially would be the two bigger ones. Tocori and Mahafo are the two other big boys that play offload, so they suck in three, four defenders around them, and then they're able to keep the ball alive. And that's where Dupont and Intermac are so dangerous. And you can see even the match against Ulster, the three that were on the ball every time they made a break was Interback, Dupont and Ramos behind them. I think it's just the importance of being really closing down that 9-10 channel and trying to stop the offloads. Like, we had a focus on getting the ball on the ground and forcing them to ruck, and getting the big men to get up and down off the ground, which I think Leinster will have a pretty similar focus this weekend, with just trying to stop the three and four, because the thing is they suck in three or four defenders, and then Dupont is able to hand off somebody, and instead of missing one tackle, you end up missing four in a cluster, and that's where they get their front football, and that's where they're so dangerous behind it, because they've got the quality, then the step, the speed, the label, and the power then in the middle with Aki. So they play the big names everywhere, you know.
They surely do. Then when you're going against Saracens, who are obviously an English team with a massive pack, you probably don't want to be putting them on the ground. Do you keep them on their feet?
They kick the ball a lot. Saracens are one of the teams that it's a pressure game they play. It's quite similar to South Africa, actually, in that they put a lot of box kicks from their nine, and they chase really well, and they try and put pressure on it, force you to play in a situation where you shouldn't really. So it's just been patient. For us, we're not small. I'm not going to say we're a small pack. Toulon are massive. We have a massive pack. We've even, obviously, Estebet, with Charles Olivier, who's nearly his 2 meters and 115 kilos. Sergio Parisse. We've a serious pack ourselves. So we're not small. But I think it'll be a very, very physical game this weekend. It always is against the English sides. And, you know, that it would be just trying to choose the right times to counter-attack, and then the right times to kick and keep the chain without putting ourselves under pressure, basically, and try to avoid playing in the areas where they can penalise. You know, if you give away a silly penalty, you get 3 points, or they kick to the corner and they have the rolling maul behind it. So it's just trying to keep yourself out of those situations and keep yourself on the front foot is what we'll be looking at doing this weekend, you know.
Well, we wish you the best with that. But speaking of South Africa, obviously Johan van Graan is gone from Munster. Graham Rowntree has taken over and Mike Prendergast is coming back. Were you ever in the line? Did the thought ever cross your mind? Was going back to Munster? Would it appeal to James Cullen?
Hey, of course it does. Munster is home. But honestly, right now I'm so happy in Toulon. It's been, even with all the ups and downs and ins and outs, it's just amazing. I never thought I'd have an opportunity like this, and I'm so grateful to obviously Patrice Kalezu, who's no longer here, to have given me the opportunity to come down here. But obviously the work you do is what keeps you here, so I'm just looking to get as much experience. Obviously this year has given me a lot more experience than I expected, but there's now I get as much experience as I can. So if an opportunity does come up at home that you're in a position that you're to put the club, to put the province in the best possible position, you know you can be selfish and say, oh yeah, I could do something now. But, you know, there's only the four provinces, and obviously Munster is where home is, and you'd love the opportunity. Who wouldn't love the opportunity to coach a Munster? But it's just, I think, for my own personal development, I need a bit more experience before I start throwing my hand up and looking to... Because we just want to put put the province in the best possible position, you know what I mean? And to do that, you need to be have the experience of gone through, like Prendy's been through, you know, ups and downs. He's been relegated. He's obviously had the quality of a couple of times. He's had the quality of players he's had in Racing. He did the experience in Stade Francais, and I know Prendy will be in that position where he feels that he can something more to the club, and I think that's where you want to be if you're going back home. That you want to be able to bring something different that they haven't heard before, something your own experiences, but also with the culture that we have at home of working as hard as we do and going as hard as we can, you know.
So don't be fooled by that French twang. You are indeed a proud Cork man, a proud Munster man, James. Yeah. And listen, time is against us, but I don't think many Munster fans, many Munster fans, before I let Ruby pop back in here, before we take a break, I don't think many Munster fans would argue with yourself, Prendy, perhaps Rog in years to come, chatting French over an El Coffee, looking out over Thomond Park.
They'd look well, wouldn't they? Half between Limerick and Cork, talking French to all of them. But James, before we let you go, my apologies for calling the top 14, the pro 14, and more and more. Yeah. Occasion there. Worry, I got slightly confused. Right. Thanks a million for taking our call. We have another quick break to take.
You're welcome, man. Take care. Goodbye.
Bye bye. RTE 2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's newest chicken and turkey range is full of B vitamins, which play a vital role in maintaining good health and well-being. Available in store now.
Game on 2FM.
So, Ireland's first pop-up pool makes a splash in North County Dublin. The 12-by-3-metre pool is fully portable and it's currently in the car park of the community centre in Donabate in North County Dublin for 12 weeks before going on to Blessington in Wicklow and then Sligo and then on to Cork. And I'm delighted to say Swim Ireland CEO Sarah Keane joins us now. Sarah, thanks so much for taking the call. A portable pool, what is the main aim that Swim Ireland is hoping to achieve with this project and how did it come about?
Thanks a million for having me on. So Swim Ireland is over 100 years old and, you know, we've been traditionally associated with competitive swimming or club swimming. But, you know, our aim is to improve the overall experience of people in the water and also to provide more swimming opportunities. So as part of our new strategy, we took a step back and said, well, what's really needed? What will make a difference? And one of the major pieces of feedback that we were getting is that there's still a lot of trouble getting in access to facilities. The pandemic has exacerbated that. We have 500,000 children who haven't been able to access swimming lessons for the last 2 years. And then there's a lot of people whereby the nearest swimming pool could be 40 or 50 miles away, particularly in rural Ireland. So we said, okay, well, what can we do that's innovative? How can we address this need for access? So that's where the pop-up pool came in, a pool that goes around the country on the back of it's like a shipping container, so it goes on the back of a truck. It's the setup time is only 2 days, and the takedown time is only 2 days. So it's very doable. This is our pilot one with Fingal, which has been—they've been really supportive. It's brilliant. So we've sort of gone through, all that's involved. So, for example, because it's only there for less than 16 weeks, there's no planning involved. The pool sits—it doesn't go into a hole or anything like that. It actually just sits on a level ground. So in this case, it's sitting on a car park. It's sitting in a car park. You know, the cars parked around it, and it means in the particular facility it's in, area it's in at the moment, it's beside a community centre. There's 4 schools around it within walking distance. So the idea then is that the community can come into it. We can do learn swim programs in it. We can have schools swimming in it. We can have private groups in it. So it's really just trying to find something innovative to bring swimming to the people, because a lot of people don't understand how popular swimming is as a sport, but it's actually the second most participated sport in the country for adults, and it's the third most for children. It's the top sport for women, and it's the top sport for people with a disability. So the demand is huge for swimming, but it just hasn't always been easy to access. So look, it's just us trying to think outside the box and do something different. So we've got a lot of support, so we're really excited about it.
Sarah, I'm sure you have, and it's a great idea. And I fully understand all the figures you've thrown out there about how popular swimming is. And as a parent, understand how important it is for your kids to know how to swim. But this is one pop-up pool, and I think you'd acknowledge we're well short of pools in Ireland. What is Swim Ireland's plan going forward for more of these pop-up pools, for more pools, full stop?
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked me that, because for the first time, certainly since I've been involved in Swim Ireland, which is quite some time, our strategy now has an infrastructure pillar, and the new national sports policy has, as one of its priorities for 2022, the development of a national swim strategy. So we're going to be able to look at this in detail. But our vision is a pop-up pool in every county. I mean, these are not expensive. Now, it does require, you know, a commitment by the local authority. It requires a commitment by us. We run them. We insure them. So, you know, there's a big commitment there from our perspective, but they're not expensive compared to your average swimming pool. So this pool costs about €150,000. Then you've got to, you know, you've got all the ramps, the changing rooms, because it's like most pools in that it's much smaller, but it has all these other things that you'd associate with it. We have a lot of disability and accessibility equipment. It has to be heated. The water has to be brought in and out. So there's all that side of things. But in total, the cost of one of these things is probably about €250,000. So it's nothing like what a normal swimming pool would cost, which is a couple of million. And it doesn't require the same level of maintenance either, on the basis of the fact that you move it around and that you change the water. You only change the water every time you move it. Obviously, you're cleaning it in between and all of that sort of stuff. So it's actually quite innovative in that sense. It's more economical. It's getting away from the fact that a lot of people don't need a 25-metre tank or a 50-metre tank. Yes, maybe our club swimmers do, maybe our high-performance swimmers do, but most people don't. Most people are well able. Like, we can fit 12 to 16 people in this small pool. We can do aquarobics in it. We can do learn swim lessons in it. We obviously would be smaller number if it's adults. We can, you know, so there's just so much you can do in it. But our vision ultimately, now this is a pilot project, But our vision is one in every county. And we've also been amazed at the amount of sort of interest from groups we didn't expect. So it, because it's heated at 30 degrees, it's really good for maybe adults who are in rehabilitation, or, you know, people who can't really do much that much. Like, we have autistic groups coming in, autistic children coming in this week. The water needs to be warm because, you know, some of them move a lot, some of them don't. So, like, it's private as well. Like, so you have maybe, you know, ethnic minority groups who, you know, want their own area. They don't want to be in a public swimming pool, you know, in public changing rooms. So it caters for them. So we've actually kind of almost been surprised by the amount of people that it'll cater for that we hadn't even thought about. But, we're very ambitious about it. But this is our pilot. So this is our first go at it. But we've already been supported by the government and Sport Ireland. So we have a second pool on order. One is coming in May. And we're already talking to a county council about them potentially buying a third, and that we will run it. So that's what we're hoping. I mean, the costs of this are very reasonable compared to your, you know, your average swimming pool.
That's great to bring swimming to more people and try and make it more inclusive. But as more people start to swim, that's going to put more pressure on our pools. And like, we have three long course pools in Ireland, one in UCD, which is for the UCD Swimming Club, then you have the National Aquatic Centre in Limerick. We need more. Has Swim Ireland plans to build another long course pool, or are we just going to create more swimmers and have less pools?
Well, we would like to see another 50 metre pool in Connaught, because it's the only province in Ireland that doesn't have one. So that's something that we have put in our strategic plan to start looking at, and we would feel that's important, even just from a kind of, I suppose, you know, treating all our provinces the same. But in terms of the wider agenda, first of all, I mean, we have a great coastline, and I think the pandemic really saw a lot more people in the water dipping or swimming. And if we can teach a lot more people to swim in these small pools, these portable pools, well, then they can avail of the coastline in a way that maybe they can't at the moment. But the other piece of it is that there's more innovation here other than just the portable pool. So there are now what you call semi-permanent 25-metre pools and 50-metre pools. So they don't last the 30, 40 years. They last 15 years. They're a lot less expensive. Again, they're maybe $1 million or $1.5 million. They can be put in. Now, they do need planning, but they can be put in less than a year, whereas that's not the case for most facilities. They are also a lot more kind of rough and ready. So from a point of view, the operational costs are less and the maintenance costs are less because of the fact that they only, you know, they're only there for a certain period of time and then they go again. But there is a lot of sustainability around them as well. So like, swimming technology and infrastructure has moved on. And I think that's what we're bringing to the table now, which is what's exciting, because we have to make it easier for people to provide, but also for local authorities, because they look at swimming pools differently, I think, in a lot of cases. So parks, for example, and libraries, they're seen as a local service, a community service, and people don't really expect them to wash their face. But for some reason, swimming pools are seen a little bit different. They're seen as sort of, you know, big entities and cost a lot, and how do you fill them? So, you know, we're bringing a different expertise to the table now to say, actually, it's not the way it always was. We can look at it differently. We can do it differently. And that means we can provide more provision.
Okay, great stuff. Sarah Keane, Swim Ireland CEO, thanks so much for taking the call.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it.
RTE 2FM.
Game on.
On 2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's new added benefits range is enriched with all your B vitamins, which are essential for your health and well-being. Available in store now.